I want to talk about Luther. And it may seem strange to you to talk about Luther in a community that is, I suppose, largely Lutheran. But it has been my discovery in the past that Lutherans know almost nothing about Martin Luther, and they know almost nothing about the tradition out of which they come, the Lutheran tradition. Now, that may not be true of this group. This group may be atypical. We'll, I suppose, discover that. But by and large, that's true. I suppose maybe that's a kind of American malady, ahistoricism. We're not very interested in history. We have all this space, so time is not interesting to us. Europeans have time, but they don't have space. They're very interested in history as a result of that. Maybe that's too easy. At any rate, Americans have been casual and forgetful about their history, and American Christians have been casual and forgetful about their respective histories, and as a result of that, have ended up making a lot of silly mistakes over and over again, or have blundered around decisions over and over again, and at least some of that seems to me to be unnecessary. So I'd like to say something about, first of all, about Martin Luther, biographically. The story is interesting, but I think it's important, not only to Lutherans, but certainly to Lutherans. And then I'd like to say something about the theological tradition that came to be wrapped around Luther as a result of his insights and ideas and discoveries. That tradition, I suppose, we call the Lutheran Church, and suggest some of the main themes that dominate or guide or are normative to that church. At that point, it's debatable, I suppose, and you can debate with me if you'd like. I hope that's the case. I certainly won't try to be provocative, but I do love to argue. So we'll see how that turns out. One more introductory remark. I don't have to tell you, I suppose, that we live in reasonably troubled times. It's hard to be a parent. It's hard to be a Christian, perhaps no harder than it's ever been. One has to answer a variety of questions to one's children about things, about young life, or about the authority of Scripture. One has to deal with Billy Graham when he comes to town. One has to respond to the programs that at home are on Channel 11. I don't know what channel they're on in your places. People that appear and tell you to touch the television screen to be healed and that sort of thing. What position does the Lutheran Church take on these various issues? And what resources does it draw upon? And once again, we're usually forgetful, and we draw upon that which is most typical of American Protestantism and often has nothing to do with Lutheranism. Now, maybe I'm simple-minded, but that seems very strange to me. So I'd like to say something first about Luther, to repeat myself. All lectures have to say the same thing three or four times because classes are forgetful. And then something about the theological tradition. So I'm going to be mostly biographical today, and I've wasted all kinds of time already, and I won't finish everything I want to do, and I'll be frustrated all week long because of that. Martin Luther was born in 1483. We're about to come to the 500th anniversary of his birth, and so if you think there have been a lot of publications about the Augsburg Convention, Augsburg Confession, wait till 1983 when we celebrate the 500th anniversary of his birth and see the kinds of adult study materials that come flowing through your various churches. He was born in what is now East Germany, in the mountainous region on a border between Thuringia and Saxony. It was a mining region, which is, I suppose, typical for this setting. The area had just recently been opened up. It was mostly copper mining and some silver mining. And it was prosperous, but it was a kind of boom and bust place. Not so much like Holden Village, because this is too isolated for the area, but a little bit like northern Idaho in the 1890s or some parts of Washington State in the 1880s and 90s when gold was discovered, and towns of 2,000 and 3,000 grew up within a few weeks or months and flourished for a time till the mines petered out. Maybe some of you come from such regions. I grew up near such areas, which are now ghost towns. And when I was a kid, we used to poke around there trying to conjure up the ghosts of the past, wondering what it was like in the late 19th century. Martin Luther's father, Hans, moved to that area. His own background was that of agriculture. His family had been peasants, farmers, cultivators. But he left the farm and went into the mining business because he thought it was promising. He thought there was money to be made there. Much the same reason perhaps most of your parents or grandparents or great-grandparents came to the United States, for freedom, but also to pursue some sort of material possibilities that weren't present in the other setting. His father was ambitious and hardworking, and I think grimly determined to make it through his own initiative and set about that. He began as a miner in the mines. He was hardworking and perhaps lucky enough so that he ended up being a foreman, and then after a time a part owner of several mines, and then part owner of a couple foundries. And by the time by the beginning of the 16th century, he was a town councillor, which means he had become respectable and part of the establishment. And by the time he died, he left not a huge fortune, but a comfortable pile of money to his heirs. It's a success story, perhaps like your grandparents. I can't, maybe it's your parents who came and homesteaded and founded farms and ended up sending their children to college. That was the condition of my grandparents, and people became wealthy by the time of my generation, though not me. You understand that if you come out of immigrant backgrounds, and I suppose most of us do, why people came to America, why people went to Thuringia and Saxony and went into the mining business. Okay, it was a family then that took life seriously. Hard work was important, success was important, material, substantial, real things were important, and Luther's father was determined that his children would, in a sense, follow after him and that they too would be successful. And he began to think that the avenue to that success was education. Again, a story that perhaps many of us know something about. The institution where I teach was established to teach Norwegian immigrants to read English and learn bookkeeping and simple secretarial skills so they could be employed. Luther's father was determined that education would be the way in which his son should succeed. So Luther was born in 1483 in a little town called Eisleben. The next year in 1484, they moved to a little town called Mansfeld, M-A-N-S-F-E-L-D, because things were more promising there, and it was in Mansfeld that life began to pick up for the Luther family. One of the biographers of Luther says that such people as Luther's family take life seriously. They don't go around giggling a lot, I suppose. They don't go off to the disco every night, but they pursue life in a very serious fashion, and I think that probably was the case. We know almost nothing about this early phase of Luther's life because there's virtually, I'm making most of this up, there are just a few lines of information about this early period of Luther's life, so it's pretty hard to psychoanalyze, as I'll try to discuss later on, a few fragments of information. He began school in 1488 in the local grammar school, where it was mostly learning language. And Latin was the language of education, and so very quickly they began learning Latin. Education was not very progressive. People learned language by memorization, by rote, and if they didn't get the memorization right, they got their knuckles rapped. Or the schoolmaster would jeer at them and put them in a big stool in the corner and put a dunce cap in their head, and the children would laugh at them that day. I can't remember if that still goes on in the public schools or not, but I suspect not. We're all winners in today's world, and we don't laugh at children who can't get their Latin verb order right. it was mostly a matter of learning language. Luther apparently did reasonably well because he continued on in school, and though we don't have any report cards, he apparently was a good student of language. He studied at Mansfeld in the grammar school, as it were, for 8 years. And in 1496, as he was kind of approaching the end of his grammar school, elementary school, Latin school education, he went for a year to the city of Magdeburg, which was and is a very important city in East Germany, one of the largest cities in Germany. He went from a little town to a large city. Some of you may have done that when you were kids and remember the towers and the size of the buildings and so on. Luther talks about the way in which he was impressed by Magdeburg and its immense size. He studied for a year there, came in contact with some practices of religious austerity, people starving themselves for long periods of time for the grace of God, people wandering around begging, trying to be holy beggars because that would get them closer to heaven and that sort of thing. And he apparently wondered about that, whether that was... I'm not trying to tell you that the reformer was born at that point. He scratched his head and said, I wonder if that's the way things are really supposed to be. But he does write about it for the rest of... He did write about it for the rest of his life, off and on. So apparently his adolescent brain was affected by such sights of religious austerity. Not the sort of things that we see, but people who would literally starve themselves to death for the glory of God, or people who gave up a noble life and went about begging for scraps of food because that somehow would prepare their souls more effectively for salvation. That whole business of salvation was a terrible problem, of course, because you had to begin the process of achieving salvation yourself. You had to do some things that God would recognize as good. And God, this great mysterious God, who was such a potent force and so fearsome, was hard to fathom. What would God recognize as good? Begging, starving yourself, beating yourself with a whip, wearing a hair shirt, doing good to others, becoming a mystic? It wasn't clear. The New Testament is not precisely clear on that. Luke may talk about Mary, but Luke doesn't talk about whether one should starve oneself or whether one should enter into some sort of privation. The last 3 years of Luther's pre-university schooling took place back in the city of Mansfeld again. Took place in the city of Eisenach, not as large a city, but there was a good high school there, and he went and kind of completed his literary and language training. He graduated, in effect, I suppose we'd call it gymnasium now, from high school in 1501. And there was no question about the fact that he was going on to the university. The university was the avenue to success, successful careers, and so his father apparently pushed him strongly to go on to the university. There's no evidence that Luther was particularly thrilled about going on to the university, but perhaps like many, he went on at his father's will. He went to the University of Erfurt, E-R-F-U-R-T, which was in one of the three or four or five largest cities in Germany, a city of perhaps 40,000 people, huge city with standards of the day. And he went to the University of Erfurt, which was the best university in Germany. It had been founded in 1392 and was the most famous, the best university in Germany. It was the kind of Harvard of Germany in the 16th century. Luther's family felt very happy that he was able to attend such a place, and Luther apparently worked very hard. He took the bachelor's degree in about a year, which was the minimum allowable time, which suggests that he was pretty well prepared and pretty bright. Others did it that rapidly, but most took 2 or 3 years. What he studied for the... Are you taking notes now so you can pass the exam? This next grade will be in the exam now. What he studied for the bachelor's degree was language once again. It's called in the medieval vocabulary the trivium. The medieval curriculum was established around seven subjects. One part, the literary part, was called the trivium, three parts. The other part was called the quadrivium, four parts. The trivium was grammar, rhetoric, and logic. And he studied grammar, which would be freshman comp, rhetoric, which would be freshman comp and public speech, and logic, which would be a kind of introductory philosophy course at that point. But it was to teach you how to use language and reason effectively, because all of intellectual discourse was wrapped around language. Number was not a very important part of it. Science was almost was a negligible part of the medieval curriculum. So everything was language. It was argument. It was understanding arguments. It was dealing with words in all of their kind of infinite variety. And you had to equip yourself to do that if you were to be a scholar or a lawyer or whatever. So for the bachelor's degree, he studied the trivium. Then he stayed on for the master's degree. Both degrees were of relatively slight importance, as a matter of fact. You had to go on beyond that to do your professional degrees if you wanted to be employable. Those of you who have children in college understand that that's still the case. You can't stop after 4 years, but 4 or 5 additional years are necessary to make your child employable after that. For the master's degree, he studied some more trivium, some more trivial subjects, some more language subjects, and added the quadrivium. That's music, astronomy, geometry, and arithmetic. It was numbers, and spent a little time working with numbers. It was not very analytical. It was not very well done. You learned a little Greek mathematics, and you learned a little music of the spheres. The planets all have their own notes, and as they slide around their concentric circles, they play their notes, you see, and that causes a sort of cosmic harmony if you have good ears. I don't know if you can hear that up here at Holden or not. We have a musician in the rear who can tell us whether the cosmic harmony can be heard up here. You all look at me blankly as though you've never heard the music of the spheres or the dance of the angels out there. They believed this sort of stuff in the Middle Ages, and as all of this turned around, you could hear this marvelous harmony if your ears were attuned to it. You've all been struck deaf. That was the sort of thing, some of the stuff that they studied. He took his master's degree in 1505. Again, it was the minimum allowable time for the pursuance of the degree. And he was very near the top of his class, I think second of 15 to take the master's degree, which suggests that he was a good student. There have been some unpleasant biographies of Luther. This sort of thing isn't done anymore because of the ecumenical movement, which suggested that Luther was pretty dumb and thus entered into the Reformation activities because he misunderstood the medieval traditions. That's not true. He was not dumb, and he did not misunderstand. He might have been wrong. We can argue that, but he certainly understood. Okay. He thought the education had been reasonably good, but there's not very much evidence, about three or four lines worth, which one can multiply into the sort of remarks I'm making. One thing that he grumbled about later on, the problem, you see, with Luther is that everything is strained through the Reformation experience. Have you had some extraordinary experience and you interpret all of the early events of your life through the medium of that experience, drag it through the experience? I don't want to suggest that Luther didn't tell the truth. Sometimes it seems fuzzy. But everything in his early life is explained through the fact of the Reformation experience. So that when he tries to remember all of these early things, they fall into a sort of pattern that sometimes seems a little suspicious to the critically minded historian or theologian. And I think it's inevitable. You've all had such an experience, haven't you? Some extraordinary thing, war, I don't know, marriage, love, and you interpret, when people come back to our institution and interpret their undergraduate days, they forget almost everything that went on. They're now conservatives and reactionaries and all that stuff, and they forget what extraordinarily unpleasant and difficult and uproarious people they were as undergraduates. And they get on the Board of Regents, all these people that were... it's the most extraordinary thing in the world. They always end up on the Board of Regents because they go out and get rich, see? They put all that energy to use, and they get rich, and then they come back and sit on the Board of Regents and frown at all of the uproarious and unfortunate and drunken behavior of undergraduates. It was precisely the sort of thing they were doing 20 years earlier. but they interpret everything now through their adult experience, and it comes out strange. Luther grumbled later on about the fact that Aristotle was so much involved in his university education. Aristotle was a Greek, and all knowledge, including Christian knowledge, was kind of interpreted or wrapped around the tradition of Aristotle, an uncompromising rationalist. Does Christianity lend itself to an uncompromising, rational interpretation? The theology of the late Middle Ages was Aristotelian. That is, it was understood or thought that everything, not everything, some things about God could be understood, some things about God could be known, and the process of salvation could be begun by mankind striving to work upward toward God and to understand Him. I didn't explain that. Do you remember in the Bible study, if you were here, the leader talked about the Greek, application of Greek thought to Western society. Greek thought, Aristotelian thought, an example of that, is rational. It tries to understand things clearly and rationally and put it in categories and thinks that things logically hang together. Whereas Hebraic thought, which is fundamental to Christianity, is not that way at all. It talks about service, but it doesn't lend itself to concepts or categories. God is a flame. You can't utter the name of Yahweh. How in blazes can you write theology about it? So Christianity tries to drag together this Greek tradition and this Hebraic tradition and make some sense of it. And we always have indigestion over that. Okay. Perhaps the late Middle Ages erred on the side of Aristotelianism and Greek thought. They tried to explain everything, and they said very clearly that man could begin the process of understanding God. Once that had happened, he could begin the process of pursuing his own salvation. God would complete it, but mankind had to begin it and do some things that would allow him to see God for what he was, and had to do some things that were clearly good. Then God would complete and fulfill the process. Luther had grave problems with that, as I'm sure you know. And as he looks back at the University of Erfurt, he says the Aristotelian tradition was unfortunate. The Greek tradition there was unfortunate. Whether he believed that when he was there is open to question, but he certainly talked about that later on. By the time he got his master's degree, he was 22. We know nothing about his spiritual life. We don't know what he was thinking religiously. He claimed when he was 20, he came across a Bible for the first time and said he was astounded. Do you remember some of those sermons when you were kids on Reformation Sunday given by people, in my case, with Swedish accents, who said, Jan Luther came across a Bible and it was chain shut. And then the Reformation took place and the chains went off the Bible. I was moved marvelously by those sermons. Well, it wasn't chained shut. It was chained to a sort of lectern because the books were so big. They were handwritten and they were enormous books, kind of like those big dictionaries in libraries. It was so big they chained it to the desk so it wouldn't fall off. So it wasn't chained shut, but it was only chained down. And one didn't need to know the Bible in medieval theology to be saved. One had to, in effect, I don't want to say it incorrectly now, the medieval church was a sacramental church, and the church was the vessel that carried you to salvation. And so salvation went on in the church, and it was the ministration of the church that brought people to salvation. And preeminently, it was the sacramental activity of the church that carried you to salvation. It wasn't necessary to penetrate to the core of the gospel to discover what that meant. It was rather necessary to be obedient. So Luther discovered a Bible, and it was no big deal, apparently. The Reformation didn't begin at that point. Now, after graduation, Luther's vocational interests were not very clearly defined, and he didn't know what he wanted to do. So those of you who are parents, have pity on your children, because they'll come to it eventually, I think. Luther's father, however, had very clear notions about what he wanted his son to do, and he unloaded them on his son. The early 16th century was a century when those vipers, the lawyers, are there any lawyers here? I shouldn't say it that way. Lawyers in the 16th century were frequently thought of as vipers. It was an unsettled time. It was a time of litigation, marvelously like our own. Lawsuits were everywhere present. Emperors were trying to hammer out their power over kings and princes, and they needed lawyers to spell that out for them. Princes were trying to hammer out their territorial sovereignty over knights and local landlords, and they needed lawyers to do that work for them. Everybody needed lawyers to do something. The church was trying to maintain its authority in society, and it needed canon lawyers to exercise and justify and rationalize and prove its various points, so that everywhere in the early 16th century especially, lawyers were needed. I don't think lawyers have ever been more necessary. The book that still needs to be written about the importance of lawyers in the early 16th century has not been written, I think. Okay, so if you were a lawyer, the possibility of rising from humble origins to the point of being an advisor to a king or an emperor or to the Pope himself was possible. And there are many instances of people who rose that enormous distance. We call it now, in one of those marvelous sociological phrases, social mobility. You could move an enormous distance in one generation. And that's something. Okay. Luther's father was determined that he would be a lawyer. Luther's own interest was slight. And so in the spring term of 1505, he set off to a law school at the University of Erfurt and attended the first session of law school. He apparently didn't like it very well. He went home in July, sometime in the first half of July of 1505, for a term break. And as he was walking back through a heavily forested area, that experience of the thunderstorm hit him. Apparently, just prior to this, he had had some trouble with a carving knife and had cut an artery. The story is a little confused. And had almost bled to death and had been frightened. I've never been that close to death, but I suspect it is a frightening thing. It was very frightening in the late Middle Ages, I should tell you that. I'm sure you probably know that. Death was a dominant theme of life. Have you traveled in Europe and seen those late medieval cathedrals? The dominant motif present there is death. Mankind dead and God judging mankind. The kind of odor of death is everywhere present in the late Middle Ages. It was a time when the age was coming unglued, when the institutions weren't working any longer, and there was an enormous fear of death. Across the front of a Gothic cathedral would be mankind with worms crawling through the bodies and God standing there as a stern judge judging mankind and finding them wanting. The church played on this fear and talked about death and sermons and so on endlessly is, I think, an appropriate word, so that people were afraid of death in the most extraordinary way and tried to find ways of dealing with the problem. So now, how do you deal with the problem of death theologically? It's a theme that is very popular, may not be the right word. It's a theme that is everywhere present in our own society, too. The books on death and dying are outnumbered only by the books by Roy Rogers and Dale Evans in the Lutheran bookstores of this world. Do you find it strange that they have strange books in Lutheran bookstores? It drives me crazy. I go and I can't find the collected works of Luther, but there are 57 books by Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. I couldn't find the Book of Concord last time I went up there, which is the collection of the Lutheran Confessions, but they had two great racks of books on speaking in tongues. All of that seems strange to me, but I have a small mind and I don't understand these things usually. I don't know how to... There are some books in the library. You can go look at the woodcuts, the pictures from the age, where death is a kind of constant theme. The books that are written about this period are typically called the death of the Middle Ages, the passing of the Middle Ages, the waning of the Middle Ages, the most famous of them is called. And death is the overarching theme, it appears, in the art, in most of the art and much of the music, and a whole lot of the theology and preaching of the period. It was an agonizing problem. I can see that you believe me, so I'll go on. It was an awful problem because the church did not give assurance. There was always uncertainty, see? How do you know if you've done enough? Have you begun the process of moving to God? Have you done some good things that God will recognize? Do you know God for what he really is? How do you know if you have done enough? And there was no formula. So, if death is this enormous problem and salvation is the goal, then how do you know if you've gone far enough so that everything is okay? And the question was not answerable in late medieval terms. All right. Luther apparently was deeply caught up in this kind of depression about death, and he had cut his artery and had apparently been close to death. As he was walking across the field, it was the middle of July. If you've been in Germany in the summer, you know that it's frequently very humid, and finally the humidity becomes so thick and heavy that it's kind of suffocating, and then there's a thunderstorm, and thunder and lightning flash around, and the humidity dissipates, and it's quite pleasant again. Luther got caught in the midst of such a storm, and as he was walking across a clearing, a bolt of lightning struck the earth near him and threw him to the earth. And he apparently cried out in desperation, "Saint Anne, save me, I will become a monk." Now, I usually stop and ask questions at this point. Who was Saint Anne? Why did Luther call out to her? And why did he want to become a monk? Because you're a little slower than most of my classes, I'll answer the questions myself. Because I need the time, I'll answer the questions myself. St. Anne, among other things, was the patron saint of the miners. When something happens to you that's desperate and awful and you revert back to your childhood, what do you cry out? Don't repeat it here. Something, I assume, that comes from a pretty primitive part of your beginnings or from a pretty basic part of your experience, doesn't it? You don't say, "Oh, hark, what is this?" St. Anne, God, of course, could not be approached. God was so fearsome, such an awful judge, that no one approached God. That's why the cult of the saints and the power of the Virgin was so enormous in the Middle Ages. One approached God obliquely through the saints. And St. Anne was the saint of the minors, so it was very natural that Luther would cry out to St. Anne to help him. But why would he want to become a monk? I've never wanted to become a monk. Have you, good Christians that you are, wanted to become a monk to kind of solidify your Christianity? It was thought in the Middle Ages that monkery was, if anyone could be saved, a monk could be saved, because he was removed from the cesspool of life. He entered the gates of the monastery, left corruption and time behind, and became a full-time expert in the pursuit of salvation, devoted himself unstintingly to pursue salvation. They were full-time experts in the pursuit of salvation. They didn't, at least, weren't supposed to do anything. Well, that's not quite fair. Their primary task, they end up doing other things, but they primarily exist to save themselves. Okay. Their spiritual marathon runners who spend all their time preparing for the 26-mile marathon. I can't imagine running a 26-mile marathon, but it's done by people I know, and they have to prepare for it all the time. Instead of preparing for 15 minutes a day, I go out and get in shape, you know, horse around a little bit like that. They run all the time. Some other imagery might be better. They spent all their time in the pursuit of salvation. If there was any hope of being saved, certainly to be a full-time expert would be better than to be a sort of part-time person, to have to pursue a career in some other area of life, and then if there was any time left over to pursue salvation. So Luther, out of his fear, I think, and out of his concern for death, and this kind of omnipresent reality, suffocating reality of uncertainty, decided to become a monk. Well, he told his father, the Hard Rock miner, and his father was not pleased at all. He thought the monks were a bunch of idiots. All they did was sit around and eat and get fat and were slothful and never did any work. And so there was a great scene, and apparently it was traumatic to young Luther. But he went ahead with his vow anyway, gave away his earthly possessions, and entered the monastery. Not with his father's blessing, which bothered him for years, but rather with his father's unhappiness hanging over him. He apparently was a very good monk. The first year, the novitiate year, is a pretty trying year for would-be monks. And apparently Luther was an ideal sort of person. If anyone should have been saved through monkery, he says, it was I. He prayed endlessly, he fasted, he engaged in vigils, he read devotional materials, and apparently he did a very good job at all the things that monks are supposed to do. And so after the first year, he took his formal vows, poverty, chastity, and obedience, and became an Augustinian monk. The Augustinians were a pretty severe bunch of monks, especially the branch of the order that Luther belonged to. Almost every monastery in the late Middle Ages, there was a kind of a lenient branch and a strict branch. They split, like churches sometimes split over matters of whether or not they're serious enough about religion. Luther's branch was a strict branch, and they spent a lot of time sanctifying themselves through Bible reading and discipline. They weren't severe in that they didn't beat themselves. They didn't wear hair shirts. Do you know what hair shirts are? It's a kind of shirt with prickly hair pointed in, so it rubs against your skin all the time to remind you that you're sinful creatures. It's kind of like wearing a bunch of steel brushes on the inside of your shirt. It's unpleasant. Luther's monks didn't do that. Things went reasonably well. After a little while longer, he took some studies to become a priest. About half the monks in this monastery in Erfurt were priests. That is, they could say the Mass, they could perform the sacraments. And in 1507, Luther performed his first Mass and apparently was terrified. If you've read Erik Erikson's book on Luther, which is a kind of psychoanalytical study, he makes much of this kind of depression that Luther felt when he said the first Mass. His father came with some friends and a gift for the monastery. His father got drunk and made a scene and carried on with his son, and Luther was upset and embarrassed. And apparently Luther was almost incapable of saying the words of the Mass. He was so kind of petrified by his fear. What if he made a mistake? What if he didn't get the words right? Would the whole activity then not take place? Would Christ not appear? And would the sacrament not be efficacious? What if he spilled a drop of the blood after the wine after it was consecrated? What if he spilled a drop of Christ's precious blood? I don't think he had a fit. Eric Erickson claims he had a fit in the choir and fell over and began frothing at the mouth. I don't think that's true. There's no evidence for that. But he certainly was fearful and had difficulty with the whole process. Well, now, he had gone through all of the activities of monkery, and he thought he could settle back now and become a monk for the rest of his life and pursue salvation as a full-time object. I think object is a word I think I like at that point, as a sort of physical fact. But his superiors thought otherwise, and they made him study theology now. He didn't want to study theology. He didn't particularly like theology. But he was sworn to obedience, and so he had no option in the matter. And he began studying theology in the school at Erfurt, and did that for about the next year. By 1508, we don't know anything more about Luther than we really knew in 1500, at least in some interior fashion. We know that he had gotten degrees and had done certain things, but we don't really know what he thought because he hadn't written anything that survived. We don't know anything except from those later years when the evidence is, if not suspicious, at least perhaps slanted. In 1508, the monastery decided that he should go to a crummy little town called Wittenberg and teach. It was an awful little town, a couple thousand people. He had been in a big city, though he wasn't interested in that. Wittenberg was along the Elbe River. It was flat and sandy and dreary. I don't know where. Every time I name some place that's like it, people come from that place, and I get in trouble after the class is over. Think of some tiny little town where you wouldn't like to go and live for the rest of your life, and it may be. The biggest industry was a slaughterhouse outside of town, and the smell wafted in from time to time. It was provincial, and a university had been founded there about 6 years earlier. The Duke of Saxony wanted a university because, this is fairly complex, and I guess I won't burden you with it. Saxony had been divided between two brothers. One brother got the dukedom, and the other brother got the university. And the Duke wanted a university too, because how could you have a decent principality, a decent state, if you didn't have a university in it? He wanted his own little Athens there in East Germany, and so founded a university, and it was really a crummy university. I should say it more elegantly. It was academically not a very good institution. There weren't many teachers, there weren't many students. They used the buildings of the monastery and the church because there were no permanent buildings. And to defray costs, they had some monks teach. Two Augustinian monks taught. One taught ethics and one taught Bible. You don't have to pay monks' salaries. They're sworn to poverty. And so it's ideal to have them on your faculty because it keeps the salary schedule down. And so Luther was called to teach for the year, to teach ethics, and went and had to primarily comment on Aristotle. I don't know if you know how lectures were done in the Middle Ages or in the late Middle Ages, but typically the lecturer would read a text. If it was Aristotle, you'd read a passage from Aristotle, and then you'd comment on it. And the students would try to memorize all this or learn it all. And then you'd read another passage and you'd comment on it. And the comments were written. They weren't delivered extemporaneously usually, but they were written. If it was a large comment, the lecturer would have the text of Aristotle written, and large columns were left, and room was left between the lines, so that if it was a long comment, it would be written in the margins. Well, if it was a long comment, there would be a separate page inserted. If it was a shorter comment, it would be written in the margins, and if it was a very short comment, it would be written between the lines. If you look at my lecture notes, I have some comments written between the lines, I have some written in the margins, and sometimes I insert new pages, and they're chaotic and very hard to give, and the students tell me that, usually. So if you're going to be a medieval scholar or a Reformation scholar, you have to learn to read Gothic handwriting, and you have to learn to decide which is the text and which are the marginal notes and which are the interlinear notes, the between-the-line notes, and which are the larger glosses or lectures which are inserted between the pages. Okay, Luther then read Aristotle and he commented from these glosses, they're called, these lectures, these comments. And apparently he did it quite well, but didn't like it. He didn't like Aristotle, he didn't like talking about ethics, and he didn't like this sort of Greek approach to learning. But he got through the year, and whether he got any commendations or not is open to question, but he got through the year. Moreover, he also did some additional graduate work there, and this is what leads one to suspect that the institution was not first-rate or perhaps even second-rate. This is the institution out of which the Reformation comes. I guess I'm trying to suggest to you something of the irony and unpredictability of history. There's no predicting where things are going to come from. There's no doubt about that. One of the things that, don't write this in your notes, I might get in trouble over this. One of the things that second-rate institutions do is to give degrees cheaply, to peddle courses all over the place and not require much work, much reading, many papers, serious thought. You just hand out credit. Sometimes you do it to football players, and we have scandals of a national sort, as we presently do. But that sort of stuff is going on all over our country in a kind of indiscriminate fashion. You can get credits any lousy place you want, and you don't have to do much work. You can get PhDs in a kind of mail-order fashion that require little, in some instances, no work. It's a remarkable sort of comment on our times, I think. Education is necessary to reach certain salary schedules, but of course no one wants to work very hard to do that, and so you buy cheap courses. We not only have cheap grace in this world, we have cheap learning too, and it is useless. Okay, that's a small aside. Yeah.
Why did they make him study theology and send him off?
Well, they needed someone to go there. They had promised to send two people to the University of Wittenberg. And so they looked about for apparently the brightest young man they could find in the monastery who could handle that without a whole lot of difficulty. And they chose Luther. I don't want to make more of this than I should. But while he was there, in about the 10 months he was there, he not only taught full time, but he got two advanced degrees. He got his first degree in theology, which is called the Bachelor of Bible, and he got his master's degree in theology, which is called the Master of Sentences, Baccalaureus Biblicus and Master of Sentences. For that last degree, you had to deal with a theological textbook called Peter Lombard's Book of Sentences. I don't know, though, the theologians here, have you gotten two degrees in the same year while you were working full time? So Luther came back to Erfurt, not only having taught a year, but now with theological degrees, advanced degrees, and so he was called upon now to teach theology to his former colleagues, those who had gone with him into the monastery, who were his peers, as it were, now had to sit in front of him and learn theology from him. It was not well received, and they objected strenuously. It's like coming into a class, isn't it? This is like if one of you would start teaching this class rather than some lofty person like me. I shouldn't say it that way. If you took a class in college and you all sat around there together and some guy went up in front of the class and started teaching it, rather than the assigned professor, it wouldn't be well received, would it? That's kind of the way in which they perceived this. But they were sworn to obedience. The abbot told them to be quiet, that Luther was their teacher, and apparently he taught for the next year. Again, we know almost nothing about what he thought about things spiritually, or we don't know very much about what he thought about things intellectually either. A few comments from this period that actually came from 1509, 1510 have been saved, and we have some written, handwritten comments in the margins of some lecture notes that suggest a little bit about what he thought about Aristotle and a few other things, and they're mostly critical. In 1510, Augustinian monks decided to appeal a legal case to Rome. Remember I told you that they were of the strict branch of the Augustinians. The larger group of Augustinians were more relaxed, and they had now been told, the monks in the strict branch, that they had to merge back in with the looser monks, the less strict monks. And they objected to that very seriously, and so they appealed the case to Rome, and Luther and someone else went down to argue the case before the courts in Rome. And so they walked down through Germany, through Switzerland, through northern Italy, and eventually got to Rome. It's very interesting. Maybe it's not interesting to you, it's interesting to me, that Luther, who was a marvelous musician, and as we've heard and as you know, thought music was literally the language of the angels, and enormously important to Christians, had no special regard for the visual arts, for those things you saw with your eye. I should like to ask you whether or not visual arts and music are any more or any less sinful or useful. Is music more helpful as an aid to faith than painting, for example? The medieval church didn't think so. The post-Reformation churches have typically thought so. And the Lutheran certainly, I think, have thought so. Luther walked through the midst of the High Renaissance and doesn't mention it, doesn't say one thing about it. He walks through Florence, the Florence of Leonardo da Vinci and Raphael and Michelangelo, and I don't want to say he was indifferent, but doesn't comment about it, doesn't go into rhapsodies over what he saw. And he walks into the Rome of Michelangelo and the Sistine Chapel and all the rest, and didn't make any enormous impact on him. If Luther had had the good eyes rather than good ears, maybe the Lutheran Church would be famous for visual arts and we'd be retrograde musically, rather than good musically and retrograde visually. That's not terribly important, I suppose. He claims to have been shocked by Rome, by the sinfulness and profligate nature of Romans. That's not to be taken too seriously, because all Germans, when they went to Italy, thought the Italians were a bunch of creeps. There's a kind of proto-nationalism booming, and one can't take it too seriously. It was kind of conventional to say the Italians were sinful, and the Germans were particularly suspicious of Rome and the church in Rome. He thought they said the Mass too fast. He thought they inserted impious words in the Mass so they could finish it sooner. Bread thou art and bread thou will remain, he claims he heard from the priest next to him at the next altar as he said the Mass. And he said, I was shocked, pious German that I was shocked. He was particularly offended at how fast they went. He said, by the time I'd gotten to the gospel, they were already through, and the next priest was saying, come on, get with it. I have 30 Masses to say today. Don't go so slowly. He walked around to all the major basilicas in Rome. If you visit all the basilicas on the same day and say a hail, say the Lord's Prayer in each one, a soul could be released from purgatory, it was thought. And so he did all that and said, I was sorry that none of my parents or grandparents were dead, because I didn't know what to do with this special blessing that I had acquired. And so it kind of went by the boards. He also visited the sacred stairs, the Scala Sancta. Those are the stairs that Christ ostensibly walked up to Pontius Pilate, 28 stairs that had been ostensibly brought to Rome by the Emperor Constantine for his mother's sake. They still exist in a little kind of chapel across the street from St. John Lateran, one of the major churches in Rome. If you've been there, you remember it. And if you crawl up the stairs on your hands and knees and say the Lord's Prayer in each of the stairs, when you get to the top, a soul can be released from purgatory too. Luther did it and claims that he had the same reaction. Who could he release from purgatory? None of his loved ones were dead yet. And he said he'd wished at least a grandparent had died so he could help at that point. Another of the things that Lutheran preachers used to do would be to say, when Luther got to the top, he stood up and scratched his head and said, I wonder if it's all true. The whole theology that was encased in good works and so on. There's no evidence that he said that, though it makes a good story. Okay. He went back to Germany, and then this great shocking news came to him that he had done so well as a university professor that he was going to be one for the rest of his life.
We don't choose university professors that way anymore, let me tell you. They have to go through a very careful screening process, and the federal government has to be pleased, and all sorts of things have to go on. The other professor that the Augustinians owed to the University of at Wittenberg was a professor of Bible. And the Duke and the university officials were upset because they kept bouncing people in and out, and because the professor of Bible, who was the chief, was the head of all of the Augustinians in Saxony, was never there. He was always in absentia. He was always on the road administering monastic disputes, and so he couldn't be there to teach Bible to people. They wanted a full-time professor of Bible, one that wouldn't be on the road, and they needed to have that kind of securely handled. So when Luther came back from Rome, his monastic superior, this man, von Staupitz, said to him, Master, that is, he had a master's degree, I found what you're going to do in life now. You're going to be a professor of Bible. Well, it's all right. Luther said, it'll kill me. I can't do it. I have no training for that sort of thing. I don't want to do that, and the demands on me will kill me. What I want is quiet and the pursuit of salvation. Staupitz, who was a very wise counselor, I think, a very wise man, said, well, God has need for lots of advisors in heaven, and if you die in your work, you can go to heaven and advise him there, and everything will be all right. So Luther was now destined to be professor of Bible. The problem was that he had to become a doctor first, and that cost lots of money. You had to have a banquet, and you had to have all of the accoutrements of office, and that cost a goodly amount of money. Luther had none, and so they went to the Duke of Saxony and said, if we promise, we will promise to have this learned man, this doctor. Having a doctorate means you speak with authority. It's a fact of no special significance in our day, but in the Middle Ages, it was very important because it branded your vocation as being one where you could speak with authority, ex cathedra. And Luther thought that was comforting all his life. The Duke agreed to provide the money that would bring the doctorate if the monks promised to keep the person in office for the rest of his life. And the bargain was made. So Luther's life was bargained away, and he would remain professor of Bible, it was understood, for all the rest of his life. And he did, as a matter of fact. And so in 1512, all sorts of things went on. He received the doctorate and began lecturing on the book of Genesis. He was still lecturing on the book of Genesis in 1546 when he died, which comforts me because I don't finish lectures very effectively. Let's see. There were, I don't know if I need to say anything else about that. Now, it is out of this experience, where is it that you most effectively serve as a Christian? As a monk on top of a mountain at Holden Village, in the dregs of life where we all live, where is it? Where is it that insight comes and the Holy Spirit moves one and all the rest? And if one takes Luther's story as a sort of model, it's doing those things that your vocation demands of you. It's serving as effectively as you can in your vocation. It's not seeking some sort of ecstatic religious experience, but rather it's doing your work. Luther's work was to lecture on the Bible, and that's what he began doing. And it was out of the combination of that activity and this mental agitation, which haunted him and got worse now, that the kind of insight that brought the Reformation came. I'm saying too much, and I apologize for that, but one never has enough time to say everything one wants. His lectures are preserved to us, so we have them. Have you ever seen a mind changing? Has your mind ever changed? Do you remember the steps involved in changing your mind? It's hard for all of us to change our mind about things that we are settled on, and the process is a very long one. Those of us who teach, or our parents, want things to happen quickly. I want to yell or bark or lecture, and I want that to happen immediately, and it takes years or decades, and I never learned that. Teachers should know that it takes a very long period of time for changes to take place. We have Luther's lectures, and we can see the changes taking place, and I don't know of anything more interesting intellectually speaking, and maybe spiritually speaking too, than to see a mind changing in this extraordinary sort of way. You can see those marginal notes changing. The text of the Bible, of course, doesn't change, but Luther's comments and thoughts about it increasingly change, and it's by looking in those marginal notes for the next 4 or 5 years that you see the Reformation exploding on the scene. But it's even more difficult because, how should I say that now? Because he continued, he did something revolutionary, his thoughts were revolutionary, but he continued to use the same vocabulary to express his revolutionary thoughts. Has a revolution happened in our own time, but we continue to talk about things in the same old categories? Luther continued to use medieval theological language to express himself, but he shoehorns new meaning into that language. It's the meaning of evangelicalism. It's the meaning of Protestantism. It's the meaning of a new understanding of the gospel. But he uses the same old words until finally the words won't take it any longer and they explode. They just burst in front of your eyes. And then all of a sudden you have a different kind of vocabulary, an evangelical vocabulary. The sort of vocabulary, I suppose, that Protestantism has been talking, the sort of ideas that have been talking. And between 1512 and sometime, scholars aren't quite sure about it, 1518 maybe, that change was taking place. And it is out of that that the Reformation comes. And if you haven't read a book that deals with that, you are theologically illiterate, I suppose. Is that too strong? How can you be Lutherans and not know something about that event or series of events that brought Lutheranism about, because we are indelibly stamped by the nature of that event? We have never escaped from it completely. It affects how we do things, how we do liturgy, how we preach. It affects all of that. The books I've listed on the board are helpful in that. The best biography of Luther is by Roland Bainton, who has been up here many times, I guess, or at least sometimes. There are at least some copies of his book in the library. The other book is by an English scholar, Gordon Rupp, and he also writes about these early experiences and the way in which new meaning is shoehorned into old words. It's a crisis of vocabulary. I think we're living through a crisis of vocabulary presently, aren't we? We have all kinds of new things we're trying to say and do and think, and we have only old words and old categories to do it, and we're enormously frustrated all the time. Well, undergraduates aren't frustrated because they don't communicate in English. They say "you know" all the time, and there's a sort of intuitive wave that goes across, and they nod back and forth to each other, and they know. But the rest of us who don't have that sort of intuition have trouble. I think you understand this because we're living through a crisis of vocabulary in our own age, and it's an interesting, but it's a frustrating and nasty problem and hard to deal with. Okay. Now what happened was that, I'm going to run out of time, was that Luther became increasingly caught up in his spiritual concerns. His fear of salvation was hag-ridden by fear and couldn't solve the problems using the medieval salvationary scheme that was available to him. And the frustration and fear mounted in the most enormous fashion until finally he was able to break through. And I guess I better say a little bit about that at the beginning of the next lecture before I continue with what I really want to talk about there. Now next week on Wednesday, you'll discover that what I'm really interested in was what I talked about today, or what I'm going to talk about on Thursday. I'm never interested in what I'm talking about. And so I always refer back or anticipate I want to say a little bit about the nature of that experience because I think it's awfully important. And then something about how Luther was immediately after that experience thrown into conflict with the medieval salvationary scheme, with medieval theology, and how he began to work through that. And that seems remarkably like our own time too.